And while there certainly were men and women who did practice forms of magic or witchcraft that the church deemed witchcraft as such, I will be focusing on how the church and state authorities imagined witches and why they engaged in large-scale witch hunts. All monsters, including the idea of the diabolical witch, are created by institutions and individuals. Monsters do not emerge from the darkness independently of human imagination. Investigating, understanding, and analyzing the context from where monsters come from demands historical precision. Monsters are closely linked to the political, social, and economic circumstances of their time. Studying them requires understanding the complex interplay between the history of religion, science, the body, theories of gender and sexuality, and cultural norms. So before we delve into the topic of witches in early modern Europe, I'm going to give you a little bit of monster theory, basically how we can think about and understand and analyze monsters. In one of the most important texts on monster theory, the scholar Jeffrey Cohen argues that the monster's body is a cultural body and must be understood in the environment in which it was created. Historians rightly agree with this assessment. We cannot understand a monster unless we think historically. For historians and what we teach our students, this means avoiding presentism. Presentism is the uncritical adherence to present-day attitudes, values, and concepts, especially the tendency to interpret the past through our modern day understandings. And this can be really challenging, especially because we might initially see the monster and the society in which it was created as weird or strange or uneducated. But I argue, and as historians would, we must avoid derision. We must avoid contempt for what we might categorize as a misunderstanding about nature or irrational thought. For historians, our primary question is not, did witches fly on brooms, or can witches turn into cats, but rather, why did people think witches and monsters existed? How did thinkers define a witch in the 16th and 17th centuries, and why? And importantly, what are the consequences? And beyond historical specificity, the scholar Jeffrey Cohen also argues that monsters dwell at the gates of difference. The monster often exhibits features from groups who are marginalized and contain fragments of those who do not belong or who are feared. And there's countless examples of these in history. Cultural difference and the language of monstrosity were frequently used to justify oppression and underscore differences in power. Crusaders, for example, made Muslims into, quote, demonic creatures as a way to cast invasions to the East in biblical terms. White settlers called Native Americans savages as a way to attempt to justify manifest destiny. Jewish communities were regularly accused by their Christian neighbors as monsters who supposedly drank children's blood for Passover as part of the everyday anti-Semitism that existed. Differences become exaggerated, and fears or hatred in monstrous enemies or the unknown are often linked with marginalized communities or groups. And when it comes to witches in particular, there is one category of difference that is central to the stories like Susanna Gaudry, and that is the category of gender. Gender is the constructed belief about what it means to be masculine or feminine in a particular society. It is a highly contested concept, and it changes over time. This is an understanding of femininity or masculinity that goes far beyond any kind of biological difference. And it defines who had power in society, who had authority, and who could produce knowledge. And women who overstepped their boundaries, who misbehaved or lived outside of the norms, were often constructed as some kind of monstrous being. And finally, the monster polices the borders of the possible. The monster can be a warning, a cautionary tale. You better behave, or the monster will come and get you. Or worse, you better behave, or you'll turn into the monster itself. So what does behave mean? Here, it means to stay within one's social role, which continues to enforce a particular social code. And the consequences of challenging this are clear. Cohen notes that, quote, "The monster is transgressive. It can be too sexual, perversely erotic, a lawbreaker. And so the monster and all that it embodies must be exiled or destroyed. Among the flames, we can see the old women of Salem hanging, accused of sexual relations with the devil. We suspect they died because they crossed a different border, one that prohibits women from managing property and living solitary, unmanaged lives," end quote. And these borders of social codes and what is possible are often particularly difficult to maintain during times of economic and social crisis. So now we're going to shift backwards after a little bit of monster theory to the context of early modern Europe. So as we're talking about witches, I want you to kind of think about these categories of gender difference, of where the borders were crossed. The Protestant Reformation in the 16th century shattered the notion of a unified Christendom. Protestant reformers like Martin Luther aimed to restore the church to its early Christian purity. He attacked the church's practices of indulgences, redefined the sacraments, and argued that individuals did not need the clergy nor any kind of spiritual deity to serve as an intermediary to God. This proved incompatible with the church's ideas, and this resulted in a break with Rome and the establishment of Protestant churches. And while witch hunts had occurred before the Protestant Reformation, the contestation of religion, this battle between the Catholic and the Protestant churches, heightened the desire to find and punish heresy. Equally enthusiastic, Protestants found Catholic witches, and Catholics found Protestant witches. So the Reformation and the subsequent reform in the Catholic Church intensified witch hunting, and also helps us understand why it would spread from place to place. The peak craze of witch hunting lasted from approximately 1560 to 1670, a time of intense religious and political dispute. At least 30,000 trials of witchcraft alone took place in the Holy Roman Empire, a territory in Central Europe. And here you can see this map. I always tell my students that there's going to be a map quiz after I show this. The Holy Roman Empire is made up of more than 300 duchies, kingdoms, territories, and free imperial cities. It is not a politically unified territory. And while princes and bishops and local rulers presumably owed loyalty to the emperor, they indeed actually had a large amount of freedom within their territories. So containing dissent and maintaining order over their particular kingdom was crucial. Witch hunts were a way for local leaders to assert their authority. The close relationship between divine and secular power also led to political consequences. This includes a series of religious wars known as the French Wars of Religion, which lasted from 1562 to 1598. This was a civil war between the ruling Catholic dynasty and a minority religion of Huguenots, or Calvinists, in France. Years of bloodshed were finally restored with the reign of Henry IV, who declared the Edict of Nantes, a proclamation of some kind of religious toleration in order to secure peace. In Central Europe, the conflict erupted into a long-lasting war known as the Thirty Years' War, From 1618 to 1648, the center of Europe, that Holy Roman Empire, was engulfed in a massive conflict in which nearly all European states participated. Mercenary armies looted villages and burned them to the ground. Villagers suffered rape, disease, starvation, which led to cannibalism in some areas, a shortage of material goods, agricultural disruption, and economic decline. In the Holy Roman Empire alone, approximately 5 million people died, about 20% of the population. And perhaps, then, given this information, we're not necessarily surprised that nearly half of all women who were executed for witchcraft were executed in the Holy Roman Empire, a place of extreme consequences from the 30 Years' War, fear and anxiety existing on a daily basis. So these are important kind of political contexts for understanding the emergence of witches. And I want to talk a little bit about the theological foundations, the idea of the Christian worldview of early modern Europe. And this will help us understand how people thought or were thinking about witchcraft. The church was central to life in early modern Europe. As an institution, it marked all of the important events of one's life: birth, baptism, communion, marriage, and death. Christian religion, whether Protestant or Catholic, underscored a very dichotomous world. There was heaven and there was hell. There was God and there was Satan. There were angels and there were demons. And what was at stake for ordinary men and women was salvation. The church provided guidance to ensure that one reached, right, the golden streets of heaven and not the fiery pits of damnation. This is also a period when no strict separation existed between magic, religion, and science, or what was called at the time natural philosophy. In fact, the term scientist is not even used until the 19th century. And religion, as formulated by the elites, was not always the same kind of religion that people practiced in their everyday life. Indeed, in the 1500s and 1600s, both Protestant and Catholic believers shared the assumption that mysterious forces controlled nature and their own lives. The world was caught between a battle of good and evil. The earthly realm was full of spirits, and all one could try and do is encourage the good and defend against the bad. Nothing that happened, the death of a lamb, a house struck by lightning, finding three yolks in an egg, was accidental. An unusual event was often seen as an omen, part of a larger plan or the action of some unseen force. And ordinary men and women sometimes depended on what the church deemed magical remedies to try and curb bad luck or foresee the future. More sophisticated patrons frequented astrologers, paying for horoscopes or advice. Peasants could consult popular almanacs or sought out wise women for spells and the most popular of all, love potions. Stories about women flying on broomsticks and congregating with other witches, these were already part of local and regional folklore. Here, we see an image of two witches whipping up a hailstorm, demonstrating the belief that witches might be able to control the weather and therefore affect planting and harvesting. But something really important changes during the era of the Protestant Reformation. The everyday practices of magic and stories of women who had familiars or tricked their neighbors turned from everyday superstitions and simply local folklore and entertainment to evidence of satanic forces that needed to be punished. Church leaders wanted people to live exemplary lives, learn the true elements of Christian faith, and the proper forms of worship. Both Protestant and Catholic leaders fostered what was called kind of a pedagogy of fear, specifically fear of the devil. Martin Luther actively participated in this. His writings indicate that he was obsessed with the devil and the amount of power that he could have on earth. Luther said on one occasion that witches were, quote, the devil's whores and that they should all be burned. From the printing presses of Germany, the center of both publishing and witch hunting, came an astounding number of Teufelbücher, or devil books. In 1552, there were about 10,000 volumes published. In the next 20 years, about 100,000 publications explored the devil and witchcraft. Many texts focused on all of the same questions. Do witches exist? Does their power depend on objects? Do witches have sex with the devil? Should witches be punished with death? And spoiler alert, the answer to all of those questions was almost always yes. Many educated men, regardless of creed, still projected considerable fear about the devil's power onto superstitious magical activities of thousands of women. The doctrine of satanic witchcraft, the idea of maleficia or evil spells that could be carried out only through a pact with the devil, had preceded the Reformation. However, in texts defining maleficia, another crucial shift occurred. Thinkers explicitly designated women as the primary practitioners of evil spells. And while Protestants and Catholics certainly disagreed on many theological issues, they both shared a similar view of the gender order. This meant that they had a very rigid understanding of the proper roles for men and women in all areas and in all stages of life. It included sustaining patriarchal control in the church, government, all public institutions, and within the family. For both Catholics and Protestants, witches were no longer people who practiced magic, but women who participated in a pact with the devil to do his bidding. This pact specifically required sex with the devil and renouncing the Christian faith. Witchcraft thus became associated with the shadowy presence of Lucifer and demons. Witches were the ultimate monster, the heretics of early modern Europe. The creation of this idea of maleficia, of connecting women specifically with evil spells, required an immense amount of work on behalf of intellectuals and authorities. An expert on witchcraft, historian Stuart Clark, argues that, quote, their views about witchcraft depended on the concepts and arguments drawn from the scientific, historical, religious, and political debates of their time. End quote. A whole host of thinkers with various intellectual interests contributed to the debates and definitions of witchcraft through the study of demonology. Demonology was the study of the natural order, in which the existence of demonic actions and effects was largely presupposed. So, for example, demonologists and natural philosophers debated whether or not witches could really be transported with their physical bodies, or whether they could transform physically into animals. They debated if sex with the devil could produce offspring, and if it did, what would that look like? Natural philosophers certainly attempted to situate the idea of the witch in the natural world. Historians who lived during this era also tried to understand the witch kind of within their own discipline. They believed that witches were part of a larger Augustinian view of history, that the world was a dramatic struggle between good and evil that would eventually end up in apocalyptic circumstances, and witches figured highly in this analysis. The witch became part of a narrative in works by clergymen or those trained to advise clergymen who contrasted demonic actions of women with their godly and mostly male counterparts. Sermons, dialogues, pamphlets, and treatises worked through definitions of magic, superstition, and witchcraft to provide advice on how to explain godly and forbidden practices. Special texts were also designed for inquisitors with rules on how to extract confessions. Others resumed responsibility for taking action, asking what practical and concrete steps should be taken to rid the world of witchcraft, who should be responsible, and how should one proceed through a trial. As Stewart argues, quote, the central preoccupation was the role of the magistrate in the fight against a crime. Ritual act, natural phenomenon, historical event, offense against God, witchcraft now became a social sin, a violation of law, and a threat to natural order, end quote. The ability and success of the prosecution of witches became a critical test of political legitimacy. Once the monster was created, she had to be destroyed. But why was the witch largely a she? We know that both men and women did and could practice magic. But why were women imagined as this kind of witch in early modern Europe? And here the idea that the monster's body dwells at the gates of difference is key, because gender helps us understand why this is the case. A key text comes from the 15th century, the Malleus Maleficarum, sometimes called the witch's hammer or hammer of witches. This text offers crucial insight into why it is the case that the witches were largely a she. This foundational work helps explain how religious leaders used both ancient and Christian texts to define women's essential nature and link her to witchcraft. And again, this is the shift from that idea of harmless magic and superstition and entertainment to Maleficia through a demonic pact with the devil. In 1584, Pope Innocent VIII heard of strange things going on in the mountains north of Italy. Two educated and well-established Dominican monks, Heinrich Kramer and James Sprenger, were tasked with investigating this remote village. There, they proclaimed to find evidence of an agrarian cult that had long predated Christianity. Using this as a starting point and other works that they had already written on the idea of witches and witchcraft, the two men created a text which included lengthy discussions of why women were especially prone to witchcraft, how to recognize a witch, how to organize a witch trial, and how to protect oneself from witchcraft. So I want to read a little bit from this as a primary source. So it will give you a little bit of sense of the language they use, the tone that they use, the vocabulary that they employ to articulate their claims. Kramer and Sprenger ask in part one, why is it that women are chiefly addicted to evil superstitions? And this is what they write. Get ready. Now, the wickedness of woman is spoken of in Ecclesiastes 25. I would rather dwell with a lion and a dragon than keep the house with a wicked woman. All wickedness is but little compared to the wickedness of women. Thus, S. John Chrysostom says about the text, this is still their words, it is not good to marry. What else is a woman but a foe to friendship, an inescapable punishment, a necessary evil, a natural temptation, a desirable calamity, a domestic danger, a delectable detriment, an evil of nature painted with fair colors, end quote. The writers of the Malleus Maleficarum, invoking both biblical texts, they also invoke ancient thinkers, like this gem from Seneca. When a woman thinks alone, she thinks evil. Oh, yeah. The there's more. The authors also argue that women are more credulous, more impressionable, and ready to receive the influence of a disembodied spirit. They have slippery tongues, unable to conceal from their fellow women those things which they know through their evil hearts. They are, they state, feebler in both mind and body and more carnal than man. There was a defect, they state, since woman was formed from the rib of Adam, and since through this defect she is an imperfect animal, she always deceives. Sprenger and Kramer also note that, quote, there are three general vices that have special dominion over wicked women: infidelity, ambition, and lust. Therefore, they state, they are more than others inclined towards witchcraft, end quote. So beyond their obsession, or I should maybe say apprehension, over women's insatiable lusts and their perversity, their belief that women are naturally inferior to men, the authors also echoed a curious and common concern that witches would rob men of their potency, stealing men's penises, and, as this fresco in Italy shows, placing them in what were called a phallus tree. Right, okay, so I wanna read, you can see, there's like a larger image taken from this fresco here. And I wanna read their exact description of this from the Malleus Maleficarum. This is what they wrote in a separate section in the text specifically about this concern. Okay. What shall we think about those witches who somehow take members in large numbers, 20 or 30, and shut them up together in a bird's nest or in some box where they move around like living members, eating oats or other feed? This has been seen by many and is a matter of common talk. A man reported that he had lost his member and approached a certain witch in order to restore his health. She told the sick man to climb a particular tree where there was a nest containing many members, and he would be allowed to take anyone that he liked. When he tried to take the big one, the witch said, "You may not take that one because it belongs to the parish priest." So perhaps Kramer and Sprenger misunderstood, deliberately or not, something that was merely a vulgar joke. In fact, this fresco was created about 200 years before they wrote the Malleus Maleficarum, that indicates that local stories probably related to fertility and to humor had endured. But they took folklore as evidence of witches' nefarious and mysterious actions. It reveals the fear that women would seize power, inverting the gender and social norms. Although they said it was merely through illusion, Kramer and Sprenger argued, stealing the penis of a man was tantamount to stealing power. And while not every witch hunter and prosecutor used the Malleus Maleficarum, it solidified and popularized the crucial assumption that harmful magic belonged exclusively to women because they were considered morally and physically weaker, and that pacts with the devil involved sexual congress. And while fears of women kind of stealing male members and placing them in trees were part of kind of this larger folklore, we can also understand how gender roles in everyday life help us explain why women were accused. When historians examine trial records, a number of common themes emerge. So first, inquisitors share a common script based on witch hunting texts, asking leading questions about intimate acts with the devil, demons who suck on women's bodies, renouncing God, attending witch Sabbaths, all of these things that we have just discussed. And these are elements that reside largely in the supernatural. But a second major theme emerges in the trial records as well. And that is what women were often accused of. And I'm going to give you kind of a list of some of the common things that women were accused of. Killing children to be used in magical rituals or drinking their blood. Using magical balms, needles, and other objects for harm. Making pregnant women ill. Causing people to vomit objects or things, quote, black as ink. Feeding herbs to a cow or horse, causing it to go mad and die. Cursing a spinning wheel. Spoiling or poisoning milk, ale, or food. Or murdering their neighbors or a family member. So what are all the commonalities here? These are part of the natural world. This is part of the material world of everyday life. And what were the roles for women in early modern Europe? They were responsible for birthing children and midwifery, care work for both the children and the elderly, domestic tasks within their own families and for others. This labor included growing food in a small garden plot, taking care of and milking a family cow, making clothes and objects for the household, sewing, brewing ale, and nursing the unwell. And many of the women who were accused also practiced herbal medicine, which was seen as a challenge to new kind of professional medical practices at the time. Many of the accused women were also older women, some of them widows or single women who lived, often literally, on the margins of their community. Misogyny placed women in an inferior role, with less political power, less economic power, and less social power. Men like Sprenger and Kramer argued that because women were inferior, they needed magical assistance to get what they wanted. And women were connected to the areas of daily life that sustained families and communities, caring for children, watching over animals, preparing food. And anxiety about food and health and fertility and reproduction were particularly important during the Wars of Religion and the 30 Years' War because of people's constant fear of growing hungry or falling ill or demographic catastrophes. Witches as monsters were seen as an inversion of the natural and thus given God-given social order. Women who were accused of witchcraft were accused of eating with their left hand. Women who desecrated rather than honored Christian symbols. They passed power from mother to daughter, and they were accused of being willful, argumentative, independent, and aggressive, instead of the good woman who was pious, silent, obedient, and married. And persecuting witches was a way to enforce social codes and women's behavior, as well as a way to work out fears and anxieties. So I have a couple images of witches that were created by artists during this time period. And these are not necessarily images that everyday people saw, but they certainly reflect a lot of the concerns and anxieties about witches and especially women's bodies. And art historians, there's a great body of scholarship that talks a lot about this set of images. One of the most well-known artists of images of witchcraft is the German Hans Baldwin Grimm. This is his image of the bewitched stable boy. And here you can see the woman or the witch in the window who is responsible for the stable boy's death. Grienne was also known for images that were very much concerned with women's bodies. in particular, images that sexualized women's bodies, that exemplified them as beings who were fertile and who were sexualized. This idea of nakedness, of inhibition, especially in descriptions of the witch's Sabbath, were often seen as monstrous, as being not normal for women in society. His image of the three witches also raises kind of a central trope in a lot of the literature on witchcraft, and that is the figure of what they called the crone. The crone was a term that was used for women who were past childbearing years. And in some cases, these were women who were seen as unproductive in their community, no longer able, right, to produce children. So the witch as an older woman, as crone, often shows up in these images as well. You can also see at the very top the iconography of the witch riding an animal backwards. This was also a very common theme, this idea of inversion of the norm. Dürer also contributed to images of the witch. This is a famous piece that historians use to think about the issue also of the woman as the crone, the way in which her body shows age, the way in which she rides a goat backwards. And the four witches, also a piece which certainly focuses on the idea of gathering. This fear of women or witches conspiring is also a common theme in many of the trial records. A handful of accusations could spark a panic that intensified over time. The process of accusations and gathering testimony, interrogation, and trial functioned as a way for authorities to maintain social order and, in their view, root out the monsters in their community. The body of a witch with monstrous marks and appearances was of particular interest to authorities. Indeed, the authors of the Malleus Maleficarum state, quote, all witchcraft comes from carnal lust, which in women is insatiable, end quote. Very much a concern. There's also a really important shift in legal codes that helped create kind of conditions for widespread accusations in the 15th and 16th centuries. Previously, European courts, both secular and church tribunals, used a system called the accusatorial system. And in this system, this procedure, a person could accuse someone of criminal behavior in a public, formal, sworn statement. And if there were doubts about the innocent, certain ordeals could be used to look for divine intervention. This could include trials by fire or hot iron, taking communion, or using kind of this idea of throwing women into the water. If she floats, she's a witch. If she drowns, she's not, but she drowned. So, yeah. And in this accusatorial system, there were consequences if you were found to have lobbied a false accusation at somebody, right? So there was kind of a system which could control and view accusations and innocence and punishments. A new system called the inquisitorial system dramatically changed procedures. Persons could accuse somebody privately, and the court was supposed to use what they called rational evidence and not ordeals for divine intervention. At this time, torture was considered a way to gather rational evidence. It would be used not for punishment, but for interrogation and confession, including demanding the names of accomplices or all of the other witches. And the normal course of events in the cases of witchcraft trials followed a similar pattern across Europe. And certainly there are many, many like local variations of this, but these are kind of the broad strokes of how a trial would take place. First, there would be the accusation of maleficia. Where did this arise? In examining trial records and other primary documents, historians have concluded that many accusations initially stemmed from familial or neighborly conflicts. Local hatreds, jealousies, or power struggles could often be manifested in an open accusation, especially toward women who were already considered troublesome, who already were on the record as misbehaving or involved in previous legal disputes, who were already targeted as somewhat problematic. In some cases, all of the property or wealth of the accused was confiscated, even if it was just a sheep or some furniture, and that property could be transferred to another member of the family. Antagonisms between extended families, stepmothers, families, and maids, envies over marriages and childbirth often featured as part of the accusations, which would then spread into a panic that witches were conspiring against authorities. After an accusation, the next stage would commence. Authorities would begin to question neighbors and other accomplices, which often added to the suspicion. For example, Jeanette Clerc, the wife of a peasant in a hamlet near Geneva, was arrested in 1539 because her neighbor's cow suddenly died after Jeanette allegedly fed it some herbs. Other accusations quickly followed. A horse went mad after she bit it. She gave an apple to a girl who got sick. Snow White fairy tale there. She fed a neighbor a meal which caused him to vomit. And then she was accused that she had killed one of her husband's relatives by throwing black powder in his face. And no doubt, neighbors believed that participating would ensure their own safety. It often did not. But they used the opportunity to air their own arguments or grievances. In areas of fragmentation of political and legal authority, places like the Holy Roman Empire, panics could get out of hand. The third stage began when the women were arrested and brought in for questioning. This was carried out by male officials, judges, notaries, and clergymen. The executioner was also an integral part of this process. The interrogation underscores how women's bodies were seen as monstrous, not just in the actions of witchcraft, but in their very existence. In front of the panel of judges, women were stripped and often shaved in order to find what was called the witch's mark. The mark was an area of a woman's body that they argued offered sustenance to demons. This could be a birthmark, a mole, or any bodily anomaly which the authorities could stab with a needle and proclaim evidence of deviance and demonic work. This further humiliated women and exposed them to what were called dishonorable men, like the executioner. Even if women were released, if they were found innocent, the stain of arrest and contact with a member of a dishonorable profession would follow them and their families their entire lives. The use of judicial torture became a central feature in witch trials. The historian Brian Levick notes that torture, quote, was predicated upon the assumption that when a person is subjected to physical pain during interrogation, she will confess the truth, end quote. However, thinkers in early modern Europe also understood the unreliability of torture and sought to provide rules and guidance to elicit true confessions and the names of other witches. The confession mattered because the criminal acts of witches' Sabbaths, of using familiars for movements, consorting with the devil of the crossroads of a village, could not be witnessed. Common forms of torture included the strappado, a pulley that raised the women off the floor by their arms that were tied behind their back, the boot, which crushed her feet and legs, The witch's chair was heated by fire from below, and they liberally used thumb screws or pulled out fingernails. And these were often applied with vigor because judges believed that women could use sorcery to help them withstand the pain. And trial records also reveal similar confessions elicited through these rounds of torture, because interrogators used a common script, often asking leading questions. It is clear that women guessed, trying to figure out which answer could satisfy the judges. The story was almost always extracted bit by bit over rounds of questioning and torture. Eventually, it revealed a very common story in all of the trial records, revealing her pact with the devil through sex, acts of magic, meeting the devil in the figures of other men, and participating in nocturnal dances with witches. Susanna Godfrey is a great example of how confession or judges used leading questions to get women to give them the answer that they wanted. She was interrogated over a number of days, asked many times how long she had been in the service of the devil. 3 years, that wasn't right. 7 years, also not right. 10 years, that can't be right. Eventually, she settles on 25 or 26 years, and they accept that as an answer. She changes her answers until the judges are satisfied. Authorities believed that they had a moral commitment to root out monsters in their communities, and they staked their professional reputations and careers on their ability to restore order. And eliciting these confessions was part of this process. After women were found guilty, they were sentenced to death. Oftentimes, this became a spectacle for the village, a moment when local authorities could proclaim God's justice and their own role in the process. The executioner would have a big meal. There would be drinking and eating before the crimes were read aloud in public, usually in a market square or the center of town. And women were killed, usually by hanging, sometimes burned. Oftentimes, their bodies were burnt and buried unceremoniously. And then after the trial and the execution, there would also be woodcuts or pamphlets that circulated, kind of praising local authority for restoring order and ensuring, right, that the authorities were doing everything they could to root out heretics, right, in that region. They were going to enforce orthodoxy and punish individuals who were accused of heretical and monstrous acts. So we might ask next, well, what changes? What ends this period of panic, of witch craze? What ends the moment or the era when women are accused en masse of participating in witchcraft? There is a decline in the number of trials toward the end of the 17th century. And there's a number of reasons for this. There's increasing social and economic stability, which meant that people were less anxious and fearful about their everyday lives. There's more food to go around. Regular reproductive cycles began to restore a demographic change. There's also a decline in religious tension and open conflict between the Protestant and Catholic Church, which meant that political leaders and church leaders didn't need to hunt heretics. Among intellectuals, there is also a critique of the use of torture and skepticism about witchcraft, which has a huge impact on the judicial system and the acceptance of torture to root out heresy. And of course, when people began accusing the mayor's wife or other individuals in power of witchcraft, witch hunts often quieted. So once an area was deemed kind of free of heretics, we see, right, a lessening of witchcraft trials in general. So historians use careful methodology to interrogate the past, relying on primary documents and close analysis to piece together an approximation of beliefs and practices. We also choose subjects or themes which are important to us and help us define our questions. We are often drawn to subjects that resonate to us personally. Many of my own questions are centered around the categories of gender, visual culture, and seek to interrogate structures of power. And I began thinking about gender and power and the idea of witchcraft when I was in college, just starting out as a history major, when I learned a story about a woman named Susanna North Martin. So Susanna North Martin was baptized in 1621 in Buckinghamshire, England. She moved with her family to Salisbury, Massachusetts, around 1639. In 1646, she married George Martin, a widower, with whom she had 8 children. She had a tense relationship with her stepmother, who denied Susanna her inheritance. And upon her husband's death in 1686, Susanna was an impoverished widow. Rumors in a nearby village turned vicious, and in 1692, she was accused of witchcraft. In the historical record, Susanna North Martin was already known as a troublemaker. She was embroiled in a legal battle over her inheritance, and she had already been accused of witchcraft a couple of years earlier. So she was put on trial. And although it seemed that she proved herself to be pious and quote the Bible freely during her trial, the New England Puritan minister, Cotton Mather, argued that the devil's servants were surely capable of putting on a show of innocence and godliness. And from Mather's recorded testimony, one witness stated that, quote, as soon as she came in, as soon as Susanna came in, Mary had fits. It is Goody Martin, and she hath hurt me often, end quote. Mather also believed her to be one of the most impudent and wicked creatures of the world, end quote. As part of the trial, Susanna was forced to submit to 2 physical examinations, wherein men looked for a physical protuberance which might give milk to a familiar. And they believed that they did find this evidence that Susanna had been visited by a witch's familiar. Susanna North Martin, a direct ancestor on my mother's side of the family, was found guilty and hanged in Salem in 1692. So I chose to study European rather than American history, but I often think of Susanna North Martin. She represented a monstrous being for many of those around her. And she serves as a reminder that monsters are not just objects of delight or fantasy, but they are created. Monsters often reflect characteristics of those who are marginalized and become stand-ins for fears and anxieties. They police the borders of the possible, and they enforce social norms and behavior. So throughout this series, I challenge you to be open to different historical beliefs and experiences, to think historically in order to really understand the monster, who created them, and with what consequences. Thank you.